Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Max Wilbert. He's a third-generation organizer who grew up in Seattle's post-WTO anti-globalization and undoing racism movement. He's a co-founder of the group Deep Green Resistance and longtime board member of Fertile Ground, a small grassroots environmental nonprofit with no employees and no corporate funding. His first book, a collection of pro-feminist and environmental essays, was recently released. It's called We Choose to Speak and Other Essays. He's also the co-author of the forthcoming book, Bright Green Lies, with me and Lierre Keith, which looks at the problems with mainstream so-called solutions to, such as solar panels, electric cars, recycling, and green cities. The book makes the case that these approaches fail to protect the planet and aim at protecting empire from the effects of peak oil and ecological collapse. So first off, Max, of course, thank you for being on the program. And second, thank you for your work in the world.
Thank you, Derek. It's really good to be here.
So today, let's talk about an organization that both you and I helped to co-found, Deep Green Resistance. But before we talk about that, let's talk about why you perceive there being a need for large-scale social and social change and also change of approaches within the environmental movement.
Sure. Thanks, Derek. So I guess I would start out that conversation by saying, you know, a lot of people have done a lot of incredible work over the years on so many different issues. And I don't want to denigrate that work. I don't want to poo-poo those people because people have made some amazing victories over the years. People have protected a lot of land. People have, you know, won some incredible victories for women's rights, for civil rights, for, you know, in all these different movements. People have been working their asses off and sacrificing and fighting for a long time. And that's great. And I think it's also important that we recognize that, you know, we've heard the saying from Martin Luther King, for example, that the arc of history bends towards justice, right? And I think that sometimes we get too comfortable with the idea. I think sometimes we get complacent with the idea that, like a Hollywood movie, real life always ends with the good people triumphing and with evil being vanquished and everyone lives happily ever after. That's a really simplistic way of looking at reality, I think. And I think because of climate change, because of so many different issues affecting the world right now, I think a lot of people aren't feeling that way anymore. They've sort of rejected that simplistic narrative of the world and are starting to perhaps feel pessimistic about things. I think a lot of people are feeling, you know, whether it's the economic downturns from the coronavirus, whether it's, you know, the ongoing police brutality and racism issues, whether it's climate change, as I just mentioned, you know, whatever it is, whatever issue you look at, the overall indicators are not looking very good. And I think if people are being honest about that, then it's challenging to face that reality, right? I'm reading a study right here from Nature, which is one of the most prominent scientific journals. They just released this study in April, a couple months ago. And it says that large swaths of ecosystems are going to falter in waves, creating sudden die-offs that would be catastrophic. That's what they're predicting for the future of this planet in terms of ecology. And this is a result of the systems of power that we live in. We know that, and anybody who's read your work, Derek, knows that, because that's such a big topic of your work, is that the destruction of the planet, the oppression that people face all around the world, the extraction of resources like fossil fuels and, you know, forests. They call these things resources and then extract value from them, just like they call us human resources and extract value from us through wage labor and in other ways. That is done in order to increase the power of the ruling class, of the people who are in charge of this society. You and I are here in the United States, and I'm sure listeners are around the world, but there are, you know, it's a global ruling class. When you're extremely wealthy, national borders don't matter to you so much. You have power globally, right? And all of this oppression, all of this resource extraction is being done deliberately. It's not a mistake. It's not a misunderstanding. It's not an accident. It's the system that was deliberately set up to funnel wealth and power to a small minority of people. And it's working very well to do that. And so I think that once we have that context, that framework, which, you know, our friend Lierre Keith talks about that extensively in her liberal versus radical talk, which if people haven't heard liberal versus radical, it's fundamental and it's on YouTube for free. I recommend you go check that out. That's a fundamental distinction of a radical analysis. In that context, right, the word radical comes from the Latin word, which means to get to the root of something. It means to understand the root of the situation. And so once you have this class analysis that allows you to look at the situation globally and analyze why this is happening and where the power and wealth is accumulating to and from whom that power and wealth is being extracted, then you start to look at the system and the problems that we're in differently. So I think it's pretty obvious to anyone who's paying attention that reform can be very helpful, right? Reform can be incredibly helpful. And, you know, you and I will applaud all the people. I know that's much of the work that, you know, some of your guests on this show are involved in, a lot of different work to protect a certain species or to reform forest practices or to reform laws around, you know, plastic pollution in the oceans or production of certain chemicals. These are very important things. And I think that we need to recognize that they are not solving the fundamental problem, because the fundamental problem is this distribution of power and the way that's being upheld. And I think the ultimate solution to something like this is what we could call revolution. And if you look in the dictionary, a revolution is defined as a forcible overthrow of a government or social order in favor of a new system. And forcible doesn't necessarily mean violent in that definition. There have been nonviolent revolutions throughout history, and there could be more nonviolent revolutions in the future. But revolutions are often, you know, very messy. But, you know, of course, the status quo is very messy as well. It's very violent as well. So I think that's the fundamental issue that we're facing, Derek. And that's why I think we need a revolutionary approach to this situation. And that helps bring us to deep green resistance.
That would be a really nice segue into there, but I'm going to mess it up by telling you something I was thinking as you were talking about the importance of reform work and the importance of protecting specific pieces of ground. I've never forgotten what David Brower said about how all of our victories are temporary and all of our losses are permanent. And I think that must be the case so long as you have this overarching destructive economic and social system.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that quote has been a really formative one for me. You know, I got involved in the environmental movement when I was young. I was just a teenager, you know, and I didn't really know what I was doing. I just got involved in the groups that were around me, right? Like everyone does. And they were promoting solar panels, and we went to the governor's office and the Capitol building, and we lobbied senators. And, you know, at the end of the day, I kind of went home and I thought to myself, this doesn't really seem to be achieving anything. And I think already at that young age, because I grew up, like you said in intro, I grew up in Seattle in this post-WTO era where you know, I was surrounded by some people who had some radical analysis, who had some real revolutionary politics. And even at a young age, coming into the environmental movement for the first time, you know, I appreciated some of the work that I saw being done around me, and I really appreciated the values underlying it, the reasons why people were doing what they were doing, the desire, you know, the drive, the passion to protect this living world all around us. But when it came down to what a lot of people were doing, you know, that David Brower quote really encompassed it for me. It felt like this is too little too late, and I don't feel like I can put my faith in these things. I don't feel like I can put my hope into these things, because I feel like that hope is going to be misplaced if I do.
And for me, when I first started being an activist, mainly the environmental activists around me were, some were quite explicit about this, and others, it was more implicit, that they were basically just holding on by their fingernails, trying to protect this or that scrap of ground, waiting for civilization itself to collapse, because they recognized that so long as civilization continues, it will continue to grind away at whatever wild places there are.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that collapse in one way could be looked at as a form of revolutionary change. It's just a revolutionary change that's not necessarily being instigated by, you know, by a revolutionary group or a revolutionary organization as we think of in a traditional revolution, right? It's a revolutionary change that's being brought about by the planet itself, by the culture destroying its own ecological foundations and coming up against the limits of its destructiveness, right? And so, yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
You know, I'm going to violate one of the main rules of interviewing right here, which is kind of like with an attorney. You're not supposed to ask questions you don't kind of know the answer to already. But I'm going to throw something out that just occurs to me, which is that I actually think that many of the revolutions that have taken place have in part been instigated by this ecological collapse. And certainly the ones that overthrow empires, because the empire is no longer able to sufficiently exploit to maintain the armies it requires to conquer abroad and to repress at home. And I mean, you can either take that somewhere or not, and then we can get back on subject.
No, I'm right with you, and I think you're absolutely right, you know, and I'm not a Leninist, but I think it's worth reading Lenin and, you know, all those famous revolutionaries throughout history. I think it's very much worth studying and reading their work, even if you disagree with, you know, large portions of it or even all of it, depending on who you are. But, you know, Lenin talked about revolution as not being something that people make happen ultimately. Revolution is something that comes about more or less organically because of those interactions between people and society and environment and that whole socio-political ecological context gives rise to these revolutionary conditions. And whether or not there is a revolution, that depends on people. That depends on people's ability to harness and change the situation in some way. And, you know, this whole conversation, I'm always thinking of this quote from James Connolly, who was a Irish Republican around the early 1900s, active in the early 1900s in the independence movement in Ireland. And James Connolly said, "Revolution is never practical until the hour of the revolution strikes. Then it alone is practical, and all the efforts of the conservatives and compromisers become the most futile and visionary of human imaginings." And the whole idea of revolution to me is fascinating because in this context that we find ourselves in today, so many people have trouble imagining. You've talked about this in your work, Derek. So many people have trouble imagining a different way of life. People can imagine the end of the world, the collapse of the biosphere, the end of all human life, and perhaps most non-human life as well, before they can actually imagine living a different way of life or living without the conveniences and the consumption and the high energy lifestyle of modern civilization. So I think part of revolution, part of building towards revolution is how do we envision a future world that is better than the one that we live in now? And then how do we concretely begin to work for that world in the here and now and be prepared for those revolutionary moments that we know are coming? Because that's the truth, is we know these revolutionary fractures in society are coming. And, you know, if you were in Paradise, California, when that fire came through, you know, all, as the James Connolly quote talked about, you know, all the efforts of the conservatives and the compromisers were the most futile and visionary of human imaginings in that moment when the inferno is sweeping through your town and the climate apocalypse is upon you, right? And that's just a small taste of what's coming. And, you know, this collapse has been an ongoing process for a long time, but it's getting so intense as the ecology of this planet really has taken such a hammering over the last hundreds and thousands of years, but especially, you know, in the last 100 years and, you know, the last decades, as this culture is hyper powered on so much fossil fuels and so much energy that is just destroying and extracting the last of all of the resources on the planet, you know, blowing up as many mountains as it can and exploiting everything, right? In that context, we need to begin to build the seeds of the future. And I think it has to combine that imagination, that ability to imagine a different future, with like a very hard-headed, a very practical organizing mindset. And that's something that you see, you know, on the right wing, I think very often. You see these preppers, you see these right-wing militia groups, and they are grappling with a reality that many people who value human rights, who value the environment, want to reject. And that's the reality that human beings can be violent, human beings can be abusive, human beings can be dangerous, you know, and often are in this culture. And we're moving towards a future of these revolutionary fractures. And I'm very worried right now that the people who care the most about human rights, the people who care the most about the living planet, are the people who are most unprepared, you know, intellectually, physically, in terms of community, in terms of being organized. I think we are some of the least prepared people out there, and we need to change that.
Well, this reminds me of something that I've been thinking as you were talking about all of these quotes and making all of your brilliant connections, which is a statement on the locker room wall when I was in college, was a slogan, luck is where preparation meets opportunity. And I think about, you know, you prepare and prepare and prepare for revolution for decades, and then luck is where that preparation meets the right moment. And if you didn't prepare, then you have no luck.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So how does all this relate to, let's bring all this back to DGR now.
Okay. So I guess the basic question is, what is DGR? And I'll run through a few different points here that I jotted down before this interview about things that DGR is and things that DGR is not. And the first one I'll say is DGR is not a mass movement. And I think that's important because I think a lot of people believe that to have fundamental social change, to have revolutionary change, you need a mass movement. You need to get as many people as possible on board. And there are cases in which a mass movement is extremely valuable. And the reality is many people are working on building mass movements right now, for environmental issues, for human rights issues, for all kinds of different things. And that's valuable work in many cases. But deep green resistance is not attempting to be a mass movement, because we think that it's more important to tell the truth, to be honest about what we're feeling, what we believe, and what we want, than it is to appeal to the vast majority of people. So we think the times that we are in, the situation that we are in, the circumstances that we find ourselves in, are so dire that most people's minds have not yet caught up to that point. You know, many people do understand how bad things are. Many people do understand what's happening with the planet. You know, when I talk to average people just at the grocery store and, you know, at the gas station and different places, people understand that there's a lot gone wrong. But for the most part, people are not prepared to organize. People are not prepared to resist. People are not prepared to make sacrifices and put in the hard work day after day, week after week, year after year, to build revolutionary organizations, grassroots organizations, people's organizations. And because of that, DGR is not attempting to be a mass movement. And that's not to say that we don't want to recruit, we don't want to expand, that's not what I'm saying at all. But we are not overly concerned with becoming a mass movement or becoming extremely popular. That, for us, is not a metric of our success. Because ultimately, we think the physical reality of what's happening on this planet is more important than what's in people's minds. And obviously there's a connection between those two things, but we can't focus on that too much. And that, again, I would recommend that people check out Lierre's liberal versus radical talk for more on that topic. So the second thing I will say is that DGR is not just an environmental movement. You know, it's got green in the name. And so many people assume that DGR is an environmental movement. But I would say it's much deeper than that. I think DGR is a political movement. It's a movement which brings together a comprehensive analysis of what's happening on this planet in terms of civilization, in terms of white supremacy, in terms of the destruction of the planet, in terms of colonization and patriarchy, and all of these different issues that I don't actually think are separate issues that we can define, you know, as falling into these different domains, as being mostly within these different domains. And yet, in some cases, it does make sense to talk about these things and analyze them separately. But it also makes sense to analyze them holistically, to tie them all together into this comprehensive understanding of what's happening on this planet. And that's something, I think, Derek, that you have done incredibly well in your work, is bring together these different threads and these different strains of critical thought that go throughout social movements, and bring them together into a cohesive analysis of the culture. The third thing I'll say is that DGR is not focused on reform. And that doesn't mean that we have people in DGR who are organizing for reform in their communities, who are doing reform work. But that's not our focus. That's not our focus. Our focus is on revolutionary change. It's on fundamental change. And I'll touch on that a little bit more here in a minute. DGR is not a group that can solve all the problems of the world. I think a lot of people, when they join any organization, they want an organization that has all the answers. You know, we're trained in that Hollywood style of problem solving where, you know, you press the right button or you enter the right code on the keyboard and suddenly the good guys win and it's all over, right? Reality is much more complex and messy than that, and is never going to be that easy. So we're not a group that can solve all the problems. We're one organization among many out there, and we're fighting like hell. We think we have an important piece of the puzzle to bring that not many other groups and organizations are bringing forward at all. So we think our work is important, but we also don't think that other people's work is not important. We appreciate, you know, that biodiversity of resistance that's out there. And what brings us together is a concrete focus. You know, I've talked several times with an indigenous organizer named Sakej Ward. And during one of our conversations, he said, we can't out-muscle the empire. We can't out-muscle the empire. We have to be able to outthink it. So I am always harping on strategic studies. That's what he said. And that quote stuck with me. And that kind of starts leading us towards, you know, a conversation about strategy and strategic resistance. Do you want to go in that direction now, Derek, or do you want to take this somewhere else?
Well, I want to go there in a moment, but there's one thing two things I want to ask you about real quick. One is, you were talking about people doing reform work, and I would sort of like it out there that we end up in some ways being almost an umbrella organization where you have people like Prairie Protection Colorado protecting specific prairie dog colonies, but at the same time using the larger analysis. So can you talk about that just a little bit, and then tie that together with, you said, I don't remember your exact language, but basically the core analysis that makes DGR unique. And so can you be explicit about that too, and somehow tie those two together?
Yeah, sure. So you're right. We do have people involved in all kinds of different work. You know, a couple that come to mind right now, like you mentioned, the prairie dog work. We have people fighting to protect old growth forest up in Canada. We have people doing mutual aid work. I'm involved in some of that type of work in my community here, you know, feeding the poor, bringing resources to people, food relocalization, building an alternative to the industrial food system. People doing that here, you know, people doing similar work in the Philippine archipelago. You know, we have people in Australia involved in anti-logging fights. You know, we have people in Germany who are part of permaculture movements. We have people here in the U.S. who are involved in anti-pipeline fights and fighting coal and fighting tar sands projects. So there are people involved in all kinds of different work in DGR. And what brings those people together, what unites those people, is a concrete focus, is a fundamental analysis. And that analysis identifies civilization as being the underlying root issue that we're talking about. And, you know, you're more of a philosopher than I am, Derek. So people should really just read your books if they want to, or you should listen to your talk. You talk about civilization if they want to dive so deeply into that. You know, I try and really focus on the practical here and now. And I think that, one of the reasons that organizing is so important is we bring together different people who have different strengths, and together we're stronger than either of us would be apart, right? You get synergies there. And so I think this is one example of that, because you are a philosopher and a deep thinker, and you have researched history so much, and you've read all of these different incredible authors and, you know, thought about their work and tied them together and written so many books about these topics. And I couldn't do that. I just don't have that in me. You know, that's not a gift that I have. That's a gift that you have. And on the other hand, I'm an organizer. You know, I like to get things organized. I like to get people organized. I like to get people together. I like to get people working in the same direction, to get clarity on goals, to, you know, to do all that sort of concrete, more straightforward organizing work. And I think I could say, Derek, that that's not work that you really like to do, or that you really feel like you have a gift for, right?
So, I can't even organize my pens.
Right. As you've said before. And, you know, it makes me laugh, and, you know, I respect your work so much, so I'm not trying to make fun of you at all.
Oh, but, I'll make fun of me. I'm completely
absurd. But, you know, an organization is how we build power. You know, do you remember who that quote is from? I think Lierre brings it up. Or maybe it's you, when people say, what can I do as just one person?
Oh, that's Kathleen
Dean
Moore.
Kathleen Dean Moore. Yeah, yeah, she says, don't just be one person. Just get together with other people, basically. And that's how we build power, is we get together. And so Deep Green Resistance is in many ways a group for people who share this fundamental analysis that civilization is killing the planet, that industrial civilization especially is facilitating the rapid murder of the planet through this extractive global economy, And that ties in, you know, an analysis of patriarchy, an analysis of racism, an analysis of colonization and indigenous land theft and genocide, that brings these things together into an analysis. And people who share that analysis have come together under this umbrella of deep green resistance. And part of why we have come together as well is not just because we share an analysis, but because we share an affinity for strategy. And in the book Deep Green Resistance, which you co-wrote, Derek, which before it was a book, there were some workshops that stretched back to, I think, 2007. In the book, in the workshops, a strategy is outlined for how to resist this particular form of empire that we find ourselves living under today. This particular form of empire that is industrial, that is globalized, that is mechanized, that is, you know, powered by electricity and global trade and global communications networks, right? And that strategy, you know, I mentioned that Sakej Ward quote earlier about we can't outmuscle the empire, we have to be able to outthink it. We need to understand that structure of empire today in order to outthink it, right? We need to understand our enemy or our opponent. And one of the ways that I think about this is that somebody may want to destroy a forest, or somebody may want to oppress a given community and force them to be slaves, or force them to, you know, work for crappy wages or whatever it is. But if they don't have the power to enforce their will, then it doesn't really matter what they think, right? If that community can defend itself, or if, you know, or if the aggressor just doesn't have the capacity to fulfill their oppressive ideals onto the world, right? It doesn't matter that they have these terrible ideas. And, you know, this is something that our friend Will was just writing about the other day in sort of this materialist understanding of power, that ideas in some ways are secondary. In some way, you know, and you're the philosopher, Derek, so I'm sure you could analyze this much deeper than I could, and maybe you can talk about it for a second, but in some ways, ideas are very much secondary to the physical reality of power and the physical reality of being able to enforce a given power structure onto society, right? So do you want to say something on that real quick?
Oh, no, I completely agree. That, yeah, ideas will certainly inform, but, you know, let's just say that, I don't know, the Manson family is running into your house. You can sit there and be as eloquent as you want, and then they stab you in the gut. I mean, so, or actually a nonviolent way that this is put is, I love the line by Jung, philosophy butters no parsnips.
Yeah,
and one way
exactly.
I've said this is that every morning when I wake up, I ask myself whether I should write or blow up a dam. And that gets to the heart of all of this, because writing is really important for some things, but writing or philosophizing or you and me chatting, doing this conversation right now, does not actually change anything in the real world. At some point, you know, they say when the rubber hits the road, well, at some point the rubber actually has to hit the road.
Right.
And you can have, you know, if you read a lot of the, Nazi sort of philosophy on its own, a lot of it's pretty stupid, you know, as well as being really horrid. It's like, hey, you know, if I would have been Hitler's advisor, I'd have been like, dude, this doesn't actually make any sense. You know, in fact, he had a lot of advisors who were saying that, but ultimately it doesn't matter if you have however many million soldiers and however many million or 100,000 tanks, you know, you can still roll over. You can still invade Austria. You can still invade Poland, and they might have better ideas, but ultimately, you know, okay. One more thing I want to say about this, and then I'll shut up, which is years ago, I did a talk at Bioneers. This was 15 years ago or so. And I was, to my knowledge, the only person there. I listened to a bunch of other talks, and they had a lot of great ideas about stuff, but nobody was talking about either psychopathology or power. And I didn't understand how you can talk about the murder of the planet without talking about psychopathology. And I didn't understand how you can talk about social change without talking about power. So
no,
I'm just validating everything you said. That's all. So I'll shut up now.
Well, thank you for that. And that is the most important thing is, you know, identifying where the power comes from, where the power that the ruling class is wielding to, you know, to exploit workers, to destroy the planet, to do all these things. What is their source of power? And, you know, you can get philosophical and you can go down all kinds of different roads. But if you want to be, you know, very physical and very materialist in your analysis of these things, in our current society, one of the main sources of power is the industrial infrastructure itself, right? We would not be experiencing a global warming issue right now without an industrial economy that was creating these industrial-sized amounts of emissions, right? If there was no fossil fuel infrastructure operating, then we would not have fossil fuel emissions. If there was no industrial logging happening, we would not have industrial-sized emissions from the logging industry. We would not have the industrial-scale impacts on biodiversity, on water quality, on, you know, stream health, on soils, and so on that's happening because of industrial logging right now. If we did not have, you know, an industrial economy, including a military-industrial complex, we would not have a global war machine that in which the U.S. empire is the U.S. empire and its military is the largest single polluter on the planet, and you end up with tragedies and genocides like what happened in Fallujah, where you have an entire city, an entire generation, an entire region poisoned for who knows how long because of the depleted uranium that got fired at them. You know, the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of rounds of this highly toxic radioactive material that was injected directly into their bodies and into their groundwater and into their soils and throughout their community, right? So the infrastructure is so important. And this is just a really simple, you know, people use this analogy all the time of the bathtub, and you've used this yourself, Derek. We are in a situation where there's a bathtub, and that bathtub is the planet, and it's being filled up with greenhouse gases, with pollution, with exploitation, with sweatshop labor, with plastic pollution, with toxins, with all of the, you know, undesirable, destructive, murderous outcomes that this culture creates. And we have all these people who are, you know, sitting next to the bathtub and are bailing it out, or are trying to work on deepening the bathtub and building the walls of the tub higher, and who are working on, you know, maybe reducing the density of the water that's flowing into the bathtub so that the tub can actually hold more water. And not many people are actually working on stopping the flow of water into the tub, right? Not many people are just doing the very direct, very straightforward work. And, you know, it's really so simple a child can understand it. The world is being destroyed by fossil fuels. The world is being destroyed by logging. You know, the world is being destroyed and many people's lives are being destroyed and impoverished and turned into, you know, caricatures of real human experience by this industrial economy and its factories and maquiladoras and sweatshop labor and, you know, factories in China that have suicide nets for their workers because they're basically slaves, right? Why don't we just shut those things down? Why don't we just stop those things from operating? And the answer is, you know, part of the answer is because that's scary. Because that's hard, because that's illegal, you know, because the laws and the police and the military, all of these institutions are set up to protect business, to protect profit, to protect the wealthy, to protect the ruling class, right? That's what the structure of law is set up to do in this country and in most every country around the world. But that's what we actually need to do. Is that fundamental, very straightforward work of just literally dismantling these things, right? So oil and gas pipelines have tripled around the planet since 1996. And over half of that tripling has been in North America. And so since 1996, we have seen the explosion of a climate movement, of an environmental movement in the United States. And at the same time, we have seen this tripling of pipelines. So if you go to that very concrete, direct, that most important measure of, you know, if you're combating climate change, stopping fossil fuels is probably your number one priority, although industrial agriculture and industrial logging should be very close behind, if not tied. But if you're looking at that metric, then the movement is failing. And I think it's failing at least in part because people are focusing, you know, as we talk about in our forthcoming book, Bright Green Lies, people are focusing on trying to build alternatives, trying to do all these things that I talked about in that analogy about the tub getting filled up, tinkering around the edges, right? Tinkering around the edges of these issues rather than going right to the heart and just shutting down these things completely. And it is scary. It is difficult. It's not easy. You know, I've been part of direct actions around the fossil fuel industry, against the fossil fuel industry. And it's not easy to shut down a refinery. It's not easy to shut down coal transport along a set of train tracks, you know, and if you try, the police will come and arrest you and maybe hurt you or worse. And, you know, I was just in the Philippines, the most dangerous country in the world for environmentalists last year and land defenders. So, you know, depending on who you are and depending on where you are, the consequences can be very serious. But that's why we're talking about revolutionary change, because this reform, this tinkering around the edges, while it may be useful, while it may be helping in some way, we need to be building and focusing on this revolutionary change, this fundamental change in the material conditions that we find ourselves in. And that's why we're in deep green resistance. That's why me and you and Lierre and all of our comrades around the world are in this organization, is because we believe and we see the necessity for this type of transformation, this very concrete material transformation in which, you know, we're not just seizing the means of production and socializing it. We're not just reforming the regulations around pollution from factories. We're not just, you know, changing the working conditions for the workers. We are dismantling these institutions. We are dismantling this infrastructure because people don't need that to survive. The world does not need that. If the world is going to survive, if we're going to survive, we can't have that anymore. And we need to be really clear and straightforward about this. And that's the value of a revolutionary organization. You know, and that's something that Chris Hedges wrote about in one of his articles recently is, you know, what revolutionaries do is they tell you exactly what needs to happen in a society, and they don't lie. And that is the power of revolutionaries, is that they inspire fear in those in power, because by speaking the truth, that in itself can begin a revolutionary process. You know, you mentioned Stephanie McMillan earlier, and one of my favorite comics that she wrote just says, every revolution starts with two people talking, and it might end in this revolutionary transformation, this material change. It might end in dismantling this infrastructure and these, you know, serious actions taking place. But it starts with people talking. It starts with people getting together and being honest with each other about what's needed and what's coming in the future and what we need to do about it.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and I have a couple questions. I mean, you were talking about what exactly is DGR or its members doing? I mean, you talked about dismantling infrastructure, but I'm not really seeing that. And so I guess, could you talk about pre-revolutionary phases for a second, I guess? So that's one thing. And then the other thing is, if people are interested, if people have enjoyed this conversation, how can they find out more? What do you want and what do you need?
Okay, thanks for that, Derek. Absolutely. So there are always going to be different phases to this type of organizing. And actually, in your book, Deep Green Resistance, you and the other authors lay out four broad phases for a movement like this, you know, in your sort of thought experiment that you lead readers through. And that book isn't really meant to tell people exactly what to do or exactly how to organize. You know, it's not a Bible that's dictating to people how this has to happen. It's a set of ideas. It's a set of predictions. It's a set of guidelines that people can follow or study to be useful in these type of movements. And the first phase is called networking and mobilization. And it's just this very basic work of raising consciousness, building organization, getting together with the people who share these ideas, and starting to formally organize structures where, you know, you build leadership skills, you build technical skills, you start to build platforms for speaking to the people. You start to, you know, build an audience and build a community, a network that you're connected to. And then you strengthen that over time. And, you know, and then in later phases, you start to do testing actions. You start to, you start to work in other ways. But in these early phases, a lot of the work is preparation. A lot of the work is training. A lot of the work is organizing. It's this groundwork. It's this fundamental work that is so important. And some people, I think, get freaked out by these type of conversations. And another thing that often happens is, you know, revolutionary movements sometimes get this machismo attached to them where it's, you know, all about who can be the hardest and who can be the most radical and all this stuff. And that's something that we've really tried to avoid in DGR from the beginning. You know, we're not doing this to prove a point or to, you know, be seen as cool or to get any sort of personal benefit. That's not what this is about. This is about what we're trying to achieve. This is about the goals and how we're trying to stop the destruction of the planet and stop, you know, the impoverishment and exploitation and brutalization of humans and non-humans around the world. And in that, there really is a place for everyone. There is a place for everyone. And one of the ways that I like to think about this is that each of us who is involved in DGR, each of us who listens to your radio, each of us who follows our movement and supports us, we all have our own gravity. We all have our own connections, relationships in our community, the people that we work with, our families, the people who we know. And we have the ability to influence those people and to start changing people's minds and changing people's actions, and ultimately to start organizing people to make political change. And everyone can contribute in a lot of different ways. If people are interested in getting involved in DGR concretely, there are a couple different ways to do that. The basic way to get involved is to become a guardian with our group, which is the basic level of joining the organization. And we love to bring new people in and provide training on different organizing skills, on different issues, on the political analysis. If people are already organizers and have a background in that, we love to bring them on board and give them a platform to help share that skill and experience with other people. We love to help people get connected with local and regional allies in DGR or outside of DGR, right? And this situation that we find ourselves in, it's really going to demand that we all step up, that we all, you know, go outside of our comfort zone to some extent and start to grow into the situation that we find ourselves in, right? You know, I often think that people who are alive today, we really have an honor if we are willing to accept it. We have the honor and the duty and the privilege and the responsibility of being the people who are born in this time of existential threat. And it's up to us how we face that. You know, it's up to each of us as individuals how we face that, how we respond to that situation. And we need long-term organizers. We need people to get involved, to work and struggle alongside us. We need people who are committed to being non-compromising and hardworking and who are ready to take risks and improvise and just relentlessly work, relentlessly organize. You know, if people can't get involved directly, there's a lot you can do to support. You can sign up for our newsletters. You can distribute our materials and information. You can distribute our pamphlets and books. Talk to people in your community. You can donate. You know, we need funding. Any resistance movement needs funding. You know, Lier tells the story of the collectors for the IRA coming by when she was a kid in Massachusetts, I believe, and gathering funds to send back to the resistance movement in Ireland. You know, DGR is not getting any big foundation funding or anything like that. You know, all our money comes from small grassroots donations, and we need to enable more organizers to be able to step away from their, you know, most of our people are poor. Most of our people are working class people who have never really had money or anything in their lives. And we need to enable people to step away from whatever job they have, most of them being, you know, crappy bullshit jobs. Oh, sorry. I don't know if I'm supposed to swear on this show, but, and organize full time. So that's a big help if people can donate, if people can get involved. If you can't do that, you know, we're available. Contact us, reach out if you want to get involved or if you want to discuss some sort of collaboration or some sort of project that we can cooperate on together. Please reach out to us. You can find our contact info on deepgreenresistance.org.
Well, thank you. Is there anything else you want to say before we sign off?
The last thing I'll say is I'll just repeat that quote from earlier, the James Connolly quote. You know, he said, "Revolution is never practical until the hour of the revolution strikes. Then it alone is practical, and all the efforts of the conservatives and compromisers become the most futile and visionary of human imaginings." We are headed for a very intense future right now, and we need to be prepared. We need to be organized, and we need to be ready. We need to, you know, get together and do the mature adult thing and face reality, come up with a plan, and put that plan into action. And that's what we're trying to do in DGR.
Well, thank you so much for all that, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Max Wilbert. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.